you know, a lot of times the best visual effects are the invisible ones. I think that definitely is true with this show.
The world ain't set up for the honest man to succeed. That should be the American dream right there.
It's exactly the reason visual effects exist, right? To enable storytelling.
This city is meant to be yours, sweetheart. What are you going to do to get it?
So my job is to, like, do everything I can to enable the storytellers to say what they want to say.
Hey guys, we're back. Been a long time since we've had the latest episode. Excited to be back with you guys. We've honestly just had a lot going on over on the Vogue Studio side of things. We're full post house where we do editorial, VFX, motion design, color grading, and sound design. And it's been a busy first half of the year. And we're also working on a fun new AI video editing assistant called ClipSense that helps you sort through hours and hours of B-roll. You know, the AI boom is just crazy right now. And I'm definitely skeptical of AI. And you say, okay, Gavin, well, how can you be skeptical if you're building an actual application that uses AI? You know, as I've been editing for the last decade, I'm sure many of you editors out there know that you can just spend so much time sorting through hours and hours of footage. And I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. The beginnings of ChatGPT beta were just starting to come out. I saw generative AI becoming a real, you know, potential threat to what we do as creatives, especially those in video production, maybe less so on the editing side. I was like, how can we create a world where AI is used as a tool for us rather than replacing the people that are working so hard to be artists and do well at their craft and create awesome original things? And also, you know, there's so much mundane tasks in video editing and post-production. So I'm wondering, how can we cut the time down that we spend on the mundane tasks in order to get to the more creative parts quicker? And logging and working through B-roll is one of those areas. Now, there's many other areas across all the different lanes of post-production, color and sound and VFX and motion design. But this is where we're putting our efforts first. All of that to say, all those plugs to say, I've had to decide, hey, the Post-Production Club podcast has got to take a little bit of a backseat. So I appreciate all of the patience from our two listeners that we have for staying with us, and excited to jump into today's episode. So with that, today we're talking with VFX team behind HBO's hit show, The Penguin, which is the follow-up TV series that was spun off of Matt Reeves' The Batman. Now, The Batman is an incredible film and is one of my favorite adaptations, trailing closely behind Christopher Nolan's. And the way that Matt has created such a gritty and realistic depiction of Gotham and The Batman, because anyone that saw that film knows how Colin Farrell was the real breakout star of that piece. So Matt Reeves executive produces, and the VFX team for the show gave us some time. We speak with Johnny Han, who is the VFX supervisor for the entire show. He worked closely with Matt and the different directors across all of the episodes. And then we have Aaron Sullivan, who's the VFX editor. So she worked closely with Johnny. And it's really cool to get to hear some of their stories about how they were involved in previs, going the extra mile to create some really awesome things to do practically. So they utilized VFX in a really cool way. They planned ahead. They worked with the directors and Matt Reeves to really bring the set to life. We dive into what scenes were done practically. They even talk about scenes that were completely CGI and VFX, which I won't spoil, but as they talk about it, it just absolutely blows my mind. And if you're watching online, you'll get to see some of the behind the scenes breakdowns of what it looked like before and what it looked like after. So make sure you check that out. But we're excited to be back. We've got another fun episode coming up after this with the editor of the Minecraft movie. So, you know, we're back. We're going to keep highlighting the people in post that are just killing it. You know, in the state of the industry right now, is there's not a lot going on. There's not a lot of work. You know, a lot of people at this level are feeling the squeeze from productions being just down and Hollywood trying to recalibrate and figure out how they recapture attention. And as needed as that is, it definitely affects those in post. And so the purpose of this podcast is really to give you guys some inspiration. And so just want to give voice to them and then also hopefully give you guys value on how you can continue to work on some really awesome stories and do the things that you always wanted to do and as it relates to post-production. So without further ado, let's jump on in. So we're live. Aaron and Johnny, it's so good to have you here today.
Great being here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So I feel like most of these podcasts typically start with letting like each of you guys introduce each other, talk about like how you got to where you are. And I want to hear that, but I would love to kind of maybe back into it a little bit and hear what it was like working on The Penguin and what led you up until that moment. How were you coming in, like working on that project specifically? Was it something that you've had a lot of experience doing at that level? Was it the first of a big project like that? Just would love to hear what it was like working on that as an experience.
Yeah. So my name is Johnny Han. I'm the VFX supervisor and second unit director for The Penguin. And basically, you know, in my whole career as a visual effects artist, a lot of comic books, Smallville and Superman Returns, Spider-Man. But it's not like I ever had a specific bias towards it. I mean, I love all those movies and that genre, but it's not like I was ever actually seeking them, and it's just sort of found me. And then, you know, many years later, I did a show for HBO called The Nevers with Joss Whedon. And that was a spectacular show. It was Victorian times, Victorian women with superpowers. So it was just ripe for visuals and had to have that period look. And from that, HBO had the show The Penguin, and I rolled right onto it. And it was just an interesting evolution of where I'd come from, because when I worked on Smallville, I was 20 years old and I was the right demographic for the show. I was this 20-year-old who loved seeing cool, flashy things. And every time we had a production meeting, it was like, hey, what do we do here? I'd be like, oh, I know. And that's because I was like the right like age for it, right? And you know, really flashy and colorful. And then we get to The Penguin, which is about super subtlety, incredible groundedness, and tasteful, right? It was like a Diet Coke to a glass of fine wine. But I'm also that much older, in my 40s now. So it almost feels like the right progression in my career, and the right, as my tastes as a person has grown, so has the work. And so it was just a dream project to work on. I felt it met me where I was in my skill set of where I am in this phase of life. And so, yeah, so that's how I ended up on The Penguin.
I'm Erin. I was the visual effects editor on The Penguin. I have been working in post, in editing, for about 15 years. And I have been VFX editing for about 10 years. And actually, when my very first credits in visual effects was in the final season of Boardwalk Empire with HBO. So that was sort of the HBO connection there. I love all stages of filmmaking. And I have kind of, when I first started in my early 20s, I kind of tried different areas in development and on set. And I really gravitated toward editing and post-production because I just love that phase of the editing. My first job as a working in visual effects, I was an assistant on Darren Aronofsky's Noah, which was a massive visual effects show. And we had like a team of four or five visual effects editors. And I didn't really know what VFX editing was. And honestly, I don't think many people know what VFX editing is. It's quite a niche trade and skill set. I just found that I actually really loved the role. VFX editing is basically like, you work with the director and the editor, and you're sort of the bridge or the diplomat between the world of visual effects and editorial, because the story, once you get into post and you're sort of looking at the footage and what you actually have to tell the story, it's changing every single day. Shots are coming in, shots are going out. The director, the editor, the producers, they're obviously trying to tell the best story that they can. But that obviously can be very expensive, and shots need to be delivered on time. So my role is to kind of like really, really pay attention of like what is coming in and what is coming out, and make sure that like all of our teams are sort of on the same page so that someone in Johnny's position and also the producer can make sure they're delivering on time, make sure they're delivering the best artistic product, and also kind of be working together. And so that's like one aspect of the job. So it can be very kind of satisfying in that way. And it's also, you have to be very tediously tracking frame by frame what shots are current and live. And so I really also loved that aspect of the sort of like putting the puzzle together and like tracking shots. I find it, the challenge of that, really fun and satisfying. Coming onto the Penguin, I think more and more people are bringing VFX editors on earlier than you would, because it's helpful to have that position during like development with pre-visualization as Johnny is working with the directors and the producers to kind of conceptualize shots while they're going into shooting. And so my job is to like then just help get everyone set up with footage and keep things organized.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point, because we started early in prep working together, Aaron, because there was such a genuine need for your, for what you do for the show. For instance, we had a bunch of driving shots to do. It was a lot of scenes with driving. And as a visual effects team, we're also there to just help elevate wherever we can and just always ask ourselves, hey, how can we do this better than the last time I did this on a show? And we wanted to take something as simple as driving, you know, with dialogue, into a more like sincere experience. Aaron, if you want to talk about that, that'd be interesting.
The way it's scripted, the Penguin is actually sort of like what would be plates that are in the environment outside the car were actually important that he would be able to interact. So it couldn't just be merely loopable footage, which is often kind of the resource in playback environments. So we actually had to like really precisely map out, look at what was Gotham in Manhattan, and do many stages of scouting out what are viable backgrounds, and then show that to a director. And like, we came up with all of these sort of like pre-recorded videos with like the scripted lines sort of like imposed on the video so that the director and the actors could get a sense of timing. And then that was like the early stage. And
It was super cool. It was like we had these beats in the script that were like, and he gets to a stop sign and then he throws the burner phone out the window. Things that like it mattered what was happening in the footage, you know, with the performance or with the what the beat of the shot was. We would actually go out and drive and find like, hey, where is there an intersection with a stop sign or a red light that's like the right neighborhood that we could film at. We went out with 360 cameras, you know, to scout out. And then Aaron would put it all together and sort of time it with the dialogue, you know, just in the bay, so that we weren't just making, as Aaron was saying, like just generic footage, but, you know, really letting what would ultimately go on an LED virtual production wall, but really like tied to what was actually happening and letting the directors make those choices of like, oh, I like, you know, what it looks like out the window at that stop sign. And you know, it sounds so minute and so like a simple thing, but we really took it seriously.
It sure sounds like it. It's remarkable to hear all that detail orientation that you're putting into the show. And I feel like that does make it stand out from a lot of shows that would not use that level of detail in how they're approaching the background plates.
Yeah, I think, and then, you know, even locations that were completely cleared as, hey, this looks fine. You know, I'm there on set, and obviously we've scouted the place 100 times, but never hurt to ask again. I'm on set and say, hey, what we see looking west, that skyline, are we happy? You know, do you foresee us needing anything there? And, you know, a lot of times it is, you know, it looks great. We're in New York. Why not? But then we get into post and we find that maybe based on the tone of the episode or the scene or what comes before it, it might help to know, you know, we really should feel like we're close to Chinatown or close to downtown. So those are decisions that no matter, even if on set, we're all good with, and it wasn't meant to, we're not fixing a problem. It's more we're furthering the storytelling wherever we can, even after it's all been shot, even after everyone's loved it. It's like, well, how can we make the scene even stronger to let the audience know where we are in town and where this character is going. So even the most innocuous backgrounds, we were just augmenting them just in such subtle ways that it, you know, a lot of times the best visual effects are the invisible ones. And I think that definitely is true with this show.
Yeah. I mean, you said it, like, this show is all about subtlety so that when the gruesome and violent moments come, they really stand out. Are there any moments that you feel like the VFX was particularly invisible that you're really proud of that no one would notice?
There's a heck of a lot. It sounds trivial, but you mentioned the gore and the gruesomeness, and we did go out of our way to make sure all of our hits of blood from bullets and things that weren't just, you know, what you'd find in like a stock library. And we really tried to shoot as much as we could. And sometimes we would do like CG simulations of the blood when it had to do a very specific thing, like splatter the wall in a certain way. But as a second unit director, I got a little bit of leeway to sort of cram in extra items on the shoot schedule of like, okay, I just need to shoot a blood element here and it'll just take me 5 minutes. And I was able to sort of squeeze those in on my shoots. But I'm trying to think, like, what, Aaron, any ideas that you felt?
Well, one is a spoiler, but...
I think we're far enough out.
More so that Lauren, the showrunner, I really admired her, not her dedication, not just her dedication to visual effects, but how every sort of little detail mattered to her with the storytelling. And so the scene at the end with Victor and Oz, which is so brutal, we had to kind of like get the scratches right because they were there, but, you know, for continuity. And I remember we would watch that scene and she would really want to watch it all the way through to just really make sure the continuity start to finish. And that's like a pretty brutal scene to watch start to finish over and over and over again. But it was very important to her to not just sort of like see it out of context, one shot out of context. And I think it was like things like that on this show where everyone was like very dedicated to like the quality of the visual effects, even if they were sort of like unseen, like you said, or you would never even think of something like that as like a visual effect, because it's not really about the production value, but it's about those details are so important because they're critical to that moment.
Yeah. And those scratches, like, you know, they were meant to like feel the intensity of how much Victor was fighting back and sort of the stone coldness of Oz. And that's a good way to see it. Like, we really looked at things as scenes, right? Which you always do when you're finaling effects, but we almost always reviewed everything as in entire scenes because it just had to be how it felt, not how it looked, right? The effects are very much, you had to feel them, but not see them. On a maybe less like subtle thing that was invisible that I think worked out pretty well is the whole kind of opening. The show opens with Oz going back to the Iceberg Lounge where Carmine Falcone, where his lair was. The whole first act was dedicated to like going back there, and it was written to be, you know, then we see the same desks and the same, you know, the lounge and where the girls from the 42 below were. But, you know, we obviously can't build a whole, recreate all the sets just for one scene or one act of the whole show. So we recreated a lot of that digitally. And I remember it was the very first day of shooting was a green screen stage of Oz just walking in green screen, which we never like to do, right? I mean, what everyone says is true. Like, it's hard to act a green screen. But, you know, it's probably because like they were still building sets and the one thing we could shoot was the all green screen stuff. So that ended up first on the schedule. And talk about like pressure, you know, that, hey, it's day one, guys. We got to do like the hardest visual effects comps of the whole show because they're entirely green screen. And you would never know that whole scene with him walking up to the club, walking through the club, walking into Carmine, coming out of the elevator into Carmine's like lounge into the bedroom, we're all green screen. And again, we don't want to do that, but the limitation to production, sometimes we have to. And we dug deep into the Batman dailies to find backgrounds, to find plates that we could cobble together and stitch together to make it feel like the same place that we were in the movie. I think it's quite seamless, but it's exactly the reason visual effects exists, right? To enable storytelling. If we couldn't do that, or if I had to go to the producers and say, hey, we can't do that. It just won't look real. We don't have a story, right? We can't tell that scene. So my job is to like do everything I can to enable the storytellers to say what they want to say and to tell what they want to tell. And actually, if I think back to that, I don't think anyone pitched that. It was probably me that pitched, hey, we can find plates from Batman. And otherwise, it was probably going to be condensed into a much smaller location, and only upon finding, and then Aaron, I think that's where we worked a lot in the beginning too, is the scouring the film of saying, hey, like in the B-roll after they yell cut, you know, the actors walk off and hey, there's a clear shot of that room, let's use that room. And then we propose to the team, to the director, hey Craig, you know, we think, and the DOP, we've got these three clean plates that we think, you know, our three like locations you can use getting up to Carmine's office. And, you know, we all talk about it. And then that's what's in the show. And you know, and it was just funny that it was day one of all things to shoot. But we're proud of it.
Yeah, that is absolutely wild. And I was wondering if what type of crossover there was between the work done on the Batman and this show for you guys. And so that's really cool to hear that you guys are utilizing a lot of that same visual language that was established there. It's one of the most visually striking films in a long time. And for you guys to transfer that over is really, really cool. Was there any more intentional collaboration as far as playing off of that film as you were working within the show?
Aaron and I would be on calls with Matt Reeves and Dylan Clark, who helmed the film. Matt Reeves was very much a part of the show in every way. And so just that collaboration of getting to talk through shots with him, I mean, that was almost like pure gold knowledge, you know, passing through to us. I did do a kickoff call at the start of production with Dan Lemon, the VFX supervisor from the movie, The Batman. And got a nice little kind of handing the torch over. We went through shot grid, or what did we do? I did screen grabs of the film of every shot I had like sort of curiosities about. And then me and Dan got on the phone and Zoom and we went through it. And then sometimes it was like, oh, but by the way, that shot that you're just asking about the train, actually the whole background is a different plate from another thing. Things I didn't even know, because that movie was just as invisible with its effects. So that was really nice getting to hear his stories and his anecdotes of not only how they did it, but like what Matt's tastes were, to sort of prepare me a little bit for that. One thing we definitely carried over was the optics of the film, right? The lenses, which, you know, was about what camera package and what they chose a shot on, but also this thing we called wet flares, which was pretty prominent in the film, where it was always wet in Gotham. And so Weta Digital on the film had done a lot of these shots where they created these like wet lens flares on the lens, which were really just so magical, but kind of creepy to look at. They kind of looked like these spiders of light on the on the lens. Dan gave me a little brief on how they did it, and which was really just smearing some silicone gel on plates of glass and shining light through it. And then Weta, of course, being who they are, would take that, you know, to the next level. And for our show, we did this. So we did the same thing, and we shone light through gels and different things in glass, but maybe not with the sophistication that Weta did. But we create our own, you know, for our budget, what we could do. And so a lot of the shots where it's wet in Gotham, you'll see this imperfection on the lens. And I think that was one of the best like carryovers of like the feel and the look of the film.
That is so cool. And the city is flooded, and to have that carry over in such a cool way is really fascinating.
Yeah, in terms of the flooding and you know, we did look up all the plans of like, what did the seawall look like? And so we got like all the artwork, we got all the plans for the sets and the builds from the film. And we really tried to recreate all that faithfully. So it did match this same thing you saw in the film wherever we could.
Aaron, how soon are you getting involved? Are you on set working together these pieces for them to be able to see what they have and don't have? Or what? Yeah, how quickly are you able to be involved in the process?
On this show, I feel like it was quite, I worked kind of outside the scope of visual effects editor, which was kind of exciting. I got to like leave the editing room and move around and be with people, because typically you're kind of with editorial and you're not really necessarily part of the production team. But I was actually in the stages with them and with the driving stuff that we talked about. You know, we worked with location. So I kind of had two offices, I guess, during. I had an office with an edit setup where I was sort of working in Premiere. And then I also would remote into my edit bay remotely so that I could have, we could bring in the directors in the studio where the big stages were. I would go to set some whenever there was playback. So if there was any questions, I could always just remote in my laptop and like make any quick changes. We also had like a special project at the Iceberg Lounge. It was shot at Marquee in the Meatpacking District. Chelsea.
Oh, it was the Apex Club.
Apex Club, yes. In the location itself, there was one main screen, a video screen, and then the whole ceiling was tiled with like over 50 screens. Johnny was like, well, why don't we put something on there? And it became kind of a special visual effects project where we hired performers and dancers, and we at the stages sort of created content for those screens for the scenes that would then become kind of part of the ambient language of this nightclub.
Wow.
And that was a whole process. We came up with all sorts of different aesthetics and tones, whether it was like sexy playback, because it was like dancers meant to be sort of like nightclub kind of ambient video. Then there was more sort of nightmarish for when the characters were on Bliss and the drug sequences. And so I was often on set for that to kind of help like with the video design of the playback. So in this show, I was definitely kind of working outside the scope of a typical visual effects editor, which was really great. I think we were kind of like a pretty tight team, and kind of everyone was kind of putting on many different hats.
I think that's the way to say it. Like our team was so game to sort of just fill in all the gaps. You know, we all knew this was something special, and even if it was outside of our normal job description, you know, what an exciting thing. You know, how many times you get to do this. So, like for instance, those video walls. It started in a production meeting where, you know, production meeting is with all departments, right? With production design and wardrobe and camera. And then it's like, all right, here's our location. You know, this is where we're going to shoot. What shall we put on these screens? And then there's like dead silence in the room. And there's some ideas. Well, what if we, you know, put this kind of footage in? Like, oh, we don't want it to feel like too like screensaver-ish or, you know, like, and everyone's like, what do the kids like even like see these days in these clubs, right? Like none of us are that age anymore. And so I kind of proposed, yeah, well, you know, I saw this cool exhibit in one of the hotels in Vegas by this great artist, and just something with like shower glass and bodies behind it. And I said, and I pulled up a YouTube video and said, you know, what if we combine this idea with this idea? And they're like, great, now it's your job. And so I'm like, okay. And that's when I say, hey, Aaron, like, we have to like figure out how to do this. And Aaron has a background in dance performance. So you were the perfect person to basically help choreograph that. And similar to like the car thing we mentioned in the beginning, we didn't just want flat playback. The scene, especially later in episode 3, Victor's having like a panic attack. Right. And it's written in the script about he's sort of like losing it. And he's it was not a drug trip. It was actually just his own emotional PTSD. We shot, you know, performances of those what seemingly generic video dancers on the wall, but they're like increasingly like losing their minds. And then by like the last stage, the dancers are like banging the glass and freaking out. So on set, we would have those four or five reels ready and work with the director, say like, all right, what level of emotional breakdown are we, you know, which, and that it's really subtle, but in the background, you'll see that the ambient videos are getting more frenetic. And then Aaron, didn't we end up using some of that in the actual show, like as shots?
Yeah. I mean, that's like a great example of like something that could have just ended up being ambient colors on a screen, but it ended up being an idea that involved every department in the show. Like we created a light box that with the help of like the crew, and then the media ended up making it back to post. So the editors started editing with the original kind of source material that wasn't just used for playback. So the original source media of the dancers is now part of the nightmare sequence. So it's just interesting how these things kind of end up having a life of their own off the page of the script. And so if you go back to episode 3, in the nightmare sequence, you can see that the dancers kind of come out of the screen. And that just kind of started from Johnny being at a meeting, being like, well, we should create something for that.
That's so cool. I'm going to go back and check that out. And I love that how it enhances the story. Like you guys were talking about the emotional communication, you know, and the story, you're trying to enhance that.
And, you know, I know everyone says it, but it was absolutely our creed. Mostly so because Lauren and Matt are dedicated to story. Matt Reeves and Lauren LaFranc. Lauren knew every shot had to exist for a reason. If we were going to, and you know, we had a tight budget, actually. I think a lot of people think we had, you know, some crazy runaway budget, and we really did not. And so we had to be so decisive. And it kind of actually will go to show that a lot of those like invisible type of effects, it mattered that much to us. And it mattered that much to us and the showrunner to say, well, if it helps story, if it helps focus down and let viewers understand what we're feeling, what we're doing, and how we, if it can affect us more, then it's worth doing. You know, then we'd shuffle the budget around to figure out other things we could lose. And the studio, I got to tell you, like HBO, like best studio to work for, you know, in terms of, you hear stories all the time about like, oh, well, we didn't have the money. But sincerely, they are so, as you know, we all know, they are story people and character people. Like they tell great stories about characters. And anytime we had to, you know, we had new stuff added or think we were pushing that budget, as long as we could really explain why it helped and why it helped the story and the characters, you know, they would never say no, and they would find a way for us to have the resources. If it meant shuffling things from other areas, it was never the cold, like, nope, that's it. They were always willing to do whatever they could to make the story as good as it can be.
That is awesome. And yeah, not something that you think of when you think of like a big studio at that level. That's cool to hear.
Yeah, a big credit to Janet Muswell Hamilton, our visual effects executive at HBO. And she just was by our side and just championed us, you know, with the kind of attention that you don't always get from the studio. So yeah, big shout out to Janet.
So what advice would you guys give to up and coming VFX artists who would want to work on something this grounded, this cinematic? The state of the industry is pretty interesting right now, and there's a lot of instability, volatility, high highs, low lows. What would you say to people that are up and coming in this field?
Specifically artists?
Yeah.
Keep your fine art sharp, like always draw and paint and be well versed in like source material, of like having like a good palette of like art history and like being able to kind of like draw on things, I think always makes you a better artist no matter what your medium is.
Yeah. And I was actually going to say something similar in that, look, the tools change every day, right? Software, especially in visual effects, computer graphics. Oh my goodness, right? Tools change every day. Don't get too used to one tool, but know your craft, right? Know your art, know your color and your composition and your fundamentals. You know, keep shooting with a photography camera as much as you can, because those things never change. Those fundamentals will always be part of the image. And as if those are developed, they'll never go out of date. I often say visual effects is not computer graphics. Visual effects is just we solve for X in those production meetings, right? We solve for the unknowns where it doesn't neatly fit into a box of, well, we shoot it this way, or the wardrobe that works this way, or the blood does this or that. We are there when no one, we don't know how to solve it. And it's our job to solve it. And that means if the tool doesn't exist, then we create it, right? We have to innovate. And so that's why don't get too used to one innovation, because next year it may not exist. Or you got to be used to trying different brushes and pencils. And I just went to a life drawing thing last night because every time you sit down and do life drawing, you always think, oh, it's going to be so much fun. And then you sit down and then, oh, you realize how difficult it is. And your brain goes through the stress of like, oh my gosh, why did I come? This is going to look bad. But, you know, I'm just like, oh, just keep going. And then by, you know, minute five, it looks awful. That by minute 15, it's like, oh, this is starting to come together. I really saved it. And then you're just honing all those instincts of like risk and reward, right? Trust your instincts. It'll either come out good or bad with every brush stroke or every charcoal stroke. And then you learn to trust yourself. You learn to trust your instincts that like, hey, okay, I might've messed up there, but I can get through it. Like it'll work out fine. And creativity, as much as visual effects is so technical, it still really does fly by the seat of your creative instincts.
Yeah.
So that's why, yeah, like Aaron said, like all those fundamentals, they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, that's good. So then talk to me about it from the like business savvy, networking connection part of the industry. You've spent a good amount of time getting to the place where you are. And if you could go back and cut that time in half, you know, like what advice would you give to be able to jump fix those mistakes to quickly get to where you're wanting to go?
I think for a visual effects artist, which I'm not, but I do obviously work with a lot of visual effects artists, and the artists who are the best to work with are, I find, the most successful in being really comfortable in asking for what they need. And like, they're not afraid to sort of like be upfront with like how long things will take, the realities of what someone's asking for, but also being collaborative and having a good attitude about it. You know, like there's like, I think a special, and I think that comes in any job, like to have boundaries and kind of know what your kind of limitations are, but to be able to negotiate, ask for those things, especially as you're coming up like communicate what you're comfortable with, whether it's money, time, schedule, demands, overtime, but do it in a way that makes everyone feel like we're all a team. I think that is what gets the job done and makes people kind of want to work with you again and makes everyone feel like we're all on the same team and things don't get toxic.
Yeah. And I just say, you know, if I think back about, you know, one thing that was told to me really, really early on in my career was like, don't make it about the money, because if you do, your heart will just never be seeking the right thing, right? And meaning if you always just are going for the job that is the biggest one or the fanciest one or the most lucrative one, you know, like that, like creativity first, money will come later. And I think that that's sincere in that, like in this business, I mean, like we refer to people as talent, right? Oh, the talent. The industry will recognize talent, right? As in if, or, sorry, talent's the wrong word, because I kind of don't like talent in this way. It sounds like it's this God-given like thing, right? I just mean hard work and dedication is noticed. And people are willing to hang on to that, right? Once you find someone who like, you're like, oh gosh, that guy works really hard and he's has a great eye. I mean, those two things I just said there is like perfect combo that you don't get very often. And people will hang on to that and then you will become valuable. And then I don't want to say money, but you know, those things will come later. Like people are willing to reward you for your creativity and hard work. You have to seek the creative first, and then those things will follow. And so what to translate that to more practical remarks is, I think one question I'm sure we all get asked all the time is, should I work at a big company like ILM, or should I work at like little, you know, studio down the road? Everyone has a different answer to that. And, you know, we're all biased by our own journeys. But I really feel like I started at a commercial house in New York City called Curious Pictures, where I was like 18 and we had stop motion animation and computer graphics, but it was small enough that like I could just hover over people's shoulders and say, hey, what are you doing? And, oh, can I try that? And in smaller places, you can do that and you can fill in those gaps and be that helpful person and become a bigger fish in a smaller pond. And that is so incredibly rounding out as well. It rounds you out as a person, as an artist, and also help you know what you like, right? You work in these smaller facilities and it's like, oh, I thought I liked animation, but man, with that guy's painting and as a matte painter, that's so cool. I didn't even know about that. Whereas people who like make this roadmap for themselves and they're like, I'm immediately going to do everything I can to get into ILM, for example, you miss a lot of the fun things along the way. It's like almost like growing up too quick, right? Like, yeah, you could do that and it's not impossible, but there are so much value in working with smaller teams, smaller crews, and you learn so much. So it's not even about working these big places. You know, work with smaller teams, smaller groups, that it's surprisingly rewarding and you'll develop a reel really quickly.
Yeah. And with the way, you know, technology continues to develop, each person is able to do more and more. And so like you said, honing in those fundamentals will, I think, allow less people to do more things. And being very lean, I think, is a very attractive, dangerous, you know, thing to have and be able to offer into a production. And I'm not saying that we should be losing artists, but more so everyone gets to have more and more experience in maybe the fields and the types of creativity that they want to.
Yeah, and in specific to visual effects and post-production and filmmaking, any chance to get to be in someone's shoes for a day or get onto set for a day, you know, as like, hey, I'm just the CG artist for this show, but you know, hey, I see that we're going to film this episode, you know, in a month. Since I'm going to be modeling that character, can I come on set? You know, things like that, where like, if it's like, hey, if you don't get in the way and, you know, you don't mind, you know, roughing it for a few days. Yeah. Like filmmaking is really fulfilling, being there on set and seeing how this crazy sausage is made, because all the visual effects schooling and training and Maya classes and nothing prepares you for witnessing like the beast of production, which is thrilling and adrenaline pumping, but it's also so eye-opening in a way where you're like, oh, okay. This is why the material we get back sometimes is so not what we asked for, right? Like, be a filmmaker, not just a visual effects artist or a Maya artist or Houdini artist.
Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, well, I could talk about this forever and ask questions, you know, all day long, but I just want to thank you guys so much for your dedication and your effort to this show. I'll leave you with this encouragement. Every week, my wife and I have been gathering with some friends to do a weekly dinner and show or movie watch. It used to be called Marvel Dinner Club when we were, you know, when Marvel was on a great run, but they have since, you know, been struggling a little bit. And so we've changed it just to being this weekly gathering. And The Penguin was one of our top favorites, if not our favorite show that we were able to watch together. We talk about it, we dissect it, we're analyzing it, we're excited about it or like really sad or surprised. And so I just want you guys to know that there are people who are dedicating time and gathering around creating moments of connection with each other around a show that you guys have put a lot of long late nights and weekends, I'm sure, into. And it has for sure paid off.
That's awesome.
That means so much. Thank you, Gavin.
Yes, absolutely. So where can people, like, what's the best way for them to follow you, keep up with your work, what you're up to?
I guess probably Instagram.
LinkedIn is also helpful. I tend to post more on LinkedIn.
Cool. Great. Well, we'll make sure to include links for people to follow up and be able to reach out to you guys and follow along on the journey, because I'm sure there's much more great stuff to come.
Well, thank you so much for having us. This was fun. Penguin reunion.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, guys.
All right. Thanks, everyone.